Merba l-semija ta' kempus 103.7 Emanuel Buttigieġ u Liam Gawċi jilqawkom għal taħdita Clio u kif edna l-aħħar darba għaddejn b'mini serje fiħdan taħdita Clio b'lisem ta' l-istorja taħt il-mewċ. Jekkontu maħna l-ġimgħa l-oħra u anki jekk ma kontux inħeġġukom li dejjem ovvjament isimgħu l-episodi li jkunu għaddew permezz tal-website ta' Campus 103.7. Għandna magħna l-Professur Dan Davis, il-ġimgħa l-oħra miegħu konna qegħdin nitkellmu dwar ir-riċerka tiegħu fejn xaqsam il-Baħar Mediterran. Professur Davis huwa minn Luther College fl-Istati Uniti huwa professur tal-istudji klassiċi u l-arkeoloġija marittima. Ħankomplu fuq l-istess tema, però ħanibdlu daqsxejn li hemm anki għax illum għandna xi ħaġa anki għal dawk il-bossa semija tagħna li nafhom huma entużjasti għat-tieni gwerra dinja. U
hemm ħafna minnhom dawn.
Iva, iva. Għaliex dan huwa wkoll speċjalizzat f'riċerka li għandha x'taqsam ma' arkeoloġija marittima li torbot mat-tieni gwerra dinja kif ħankunu qegħdin nisploraw flimkien miegħu illum. Allura ħanaddu issa biex inkomplu nitkellmu ma' dan. Fakkar li dal-episodju naturalment ħajkun bl-Ingliż ukoll. Dan, thank you so much for being with us again. You survived the previous one and you seem to be enjoying it.
My pleasure.
So last time I was saying that last time we explored your work in the Black Sea, the Aegean, the Mediterranean. But there's another site to you, another Dan that we will talk about today. The one that is more related to work that has to do with the Second World War. Maritime archaeology of the Second World War. And you were saying how, you know, you are the lead archaeologist for a team from something called the Project Recovery at the University of Delaware. And you're also a partner with something called the DPAA, which stands for the Defense Prisoners of War MIA Accounting Agency, which searches underwater for U.S. planes from the Second World War all over the world. So, can you break that down a little bit?
Yes, that's going to be a long answer.
Because I've said a lot there. How did you get involved with this? What does it involve? Over to you.
Sure, sure. Let me describe first what DPAA is, because I think this place is pretty special. Right, Defense POW MIA Accounting Agency, right? So heavy emphasis on the accounting. DPAA is part of the Defense Department of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so it's run as a military agency.
Yeah.
And its sole job, its sole purpose is to go around the world and both above and below water look for MIAs from all kinds of past conflicts, not just World War II, although that's where most of them are, but also from Korea, from Vietnam, and even from more recent conflicts.
MIAs being missing in action.
Missing in action.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's quite funny. MIA is also Malta International Airport. So
that's why I thought it's best
yes,
to
yes,
clarify.
A few weeks ago, my girlfriend texted me MIA, and I said, she's missing in action. No, it's Malta International Airport.
Yeah, I think it's also Miami's call sign.
Okay.
But yeah, no, MIAs here in this case. MIAs are missing in action. You know, the United States had 417,000 deaths in World War II.
My goodness.
From among all the soldiers, airmen, Marines, and sailors. And out of that, around 72,000 remain missing in action. That's almost one out of five.
Till today.
Until today.
Gosh.
Now, the DPAA is pecking away. They're, you know, trying to reduce that number every day. But there's still an amazing, an enormous number of people still missing from that conflict. Like I said, one out of five. So that means one out of five families don't know what happened to their loved one. Mm. Great uncle, grandfather, you know, distant cousin, whatever. They don't have closure. There's been no healing. There's just been confusion that surrounds the end of the life of their loved one. And so that's what DPAA is there for, is to find those people and try to bring them home, repatriate them, and give them a proper burial so that their families can find closure. So we find it a very noble endeavor.
Indeed.
And to my knowledge, no other country does this. Germany doesn't do it. Japan doesn't do it. This isn't to knock those countries. They have tremendous numbers of war dead. But there's just some other dynamic at work in the U.S. where we think that that is really important, and we pour a lot of resources into doing that. Yeah. Now, it's not to say that that other countries don't have accounting agencies. They do. But to my knowledge, they're not out proactively looking for their war dead. They react. They don't proactively.
What is that proactive activity? How do you can you give us a concrete example? For example, from Malta.
Absolutely. So here in the Mediterranean during World War II, there are a number of American bombers and fighter planes that went down. Some of them here off Malta. And it's my understanding that at least one bomber and a couple of fighter planes, maybe more bombers, have been lost too, but at least one I know of, that has already been found and has already been investigated under a DPAA oversight with one of your local scholars, actually an international scholar of great repute, Timmy Gammon, who I have a tremendous amount of respect for. So, in the Mediterranean, there are hundreds and hundreds of cases of airplanes that went down, and we still need to find those. But in the Atlantic and in the Pacific, that's where the big numbers are for airmen who went down. And so I work for Project Recover and the University of Delaware. They're in partnership with each other as a partner, as a further partner to the DPAA. And so we're looking mostly in the Pacific region right now with the group that I work with.
Okay.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in this?
So as life happens, it's always serendipity. It's like who you know, it's connections. And I happen to be working in the Aegean with Bob Ballard's group 1 year. And a friend of mine was also working in the Aegean doing oceanography. And he asked me if I was interested in coming over to see his project. And so I did. And then he introduced me to his boss at the time. And it was his boss who was one of the co-founders of Project Recover.
All right.
Okay.
And he at the time, he happened to be looking around for a marine archaeologist to join his team. And so his name is Mark Moline. He's one of the co-founders along with Dr. Pat Scannon. They founded Project Recover, and Mark Moline at the time was the head of the oceanography department at the University of Delaware. And so
hence why the connection.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Which means that Mark had access to a lot of technology that he could bring to bear for the search for MIAs.
Yeah.
How does it go about? So you have a list of these 72,000 MIAs and you go, okay, let's start with number one. Or is it a more educated way of doing it?
Well, there is more nuance to it, certainly. Yes. I wish we could just start with one and go through the list, right? But the thing is, we don't have great information for the majority of the cases. You know, there are airlines.
I assume if there was the information, they wouldn't be missing in the first place, or less chance of them being missing. So,
Very valid. Very valid point.
Yeah, there is that. Well, we have historians also on our team, and they look through all the cases. It turns out that all of those officers in World War II who were always doing paperwork were doing us a favor.
Yeah.
They're always complaining about paperwork, right?
Yes, God bless the paperwork.
The paperwork is doing the work for us now. And so that investment in their time is actually quite precious. As you sift through all the cases, you find that there are certain ones that have better or more accurate or seemingly more accurate positional information on the location of the crashes. We deal mostly with planes.
Okay.
99% of what we do is air crashes. Mm-hmm. And so all of those reports of plane crashes and, personnel records that detail what happened with the air crash and who's missing are still there. You can still look at them. They've all been archived. They're all in digital format. So our historians sit through those and they look for the hotspots. Like where are the best cases and are they aggregated in one area where we can go there and expect multiple discoveries, not just one or two, but multiple aircraft discoveries at the same time. We try to maximize our field time.
Yeah. In a sense, you see the contrast between, last time you were telling us how difficult it is to raise money to do a dig for an ancient ship.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, I imagine, the resources are not infinite, but certainly they are there. And obviously that must facilitate work quite a lot.
Yeah, DPAA does have deep pockets, but they you know, they keep an eye on their funds and they try to, you know, maximize their efficiencies as they should.
Yeah.
DPAA realized a few years back that their teams of specialists could only do so much. And it made sense as technology comes along and as oceanography departments are adopting technologies, it made sense for them to reach out and partner with academics and other nonprofit institutions to, to cover more ground. Yeah, exactly. And then they would provide the information, or we ourselves would have our own historians who would,
collaborate or
exactly. Yeah. Collaborate with them and narrow it down. And so, yeah, DPA, we're not the only nonprofit that partners with DPAA. That is, Project Recover is not the only one. There are many others, and they're all good. They're all doing great work. Mm-hmm.
I want to drag you a little bit to the side with our arguments, because this is something that throughout my experience at the museum, with I get asked the question, if it's an American bomber, the property is still of the U.S. Air Force, of the U.S. Navy. Can you talk about that with our listeners? Because it is something that sometimes it's not that clear cut. And I think it's something that we need to educate the general public about it.
Well, certainly. The U.S. government considers warships that sank to be war graves, right? So they're not to be touched. They are U.S. property, no matter where they are, and we don't try to recover those bodies. They're resting where we think they should be. Air crashes we treat differently, and airplanes are found all over the world, and we think of them as our property. We hope that host countries are not touching them, or at least they're managing those sites. You know, it's okay to scuba dive on those sites, I think, as long as no one's taking anything.
Taking souvenirs and treasure hunters, yes.
Yeah. But if anyone here is listening who is a diver, you know we like to collect things. I'm a diver too. Who doesn't like to collect things underwater? Don't do that, especially with American planes, but really with any planes. You know, we work all over the world, and sometimes we find enemy planes, and they've been stripped clean. Same with enemy ships. They've been stripped clean of everything, including human bones.
Yes.
And for some reason, divers think that anything found underwater is personal property. And it just isn't. There are sensitivities that should be observed for that sort of thing. There's also sort of a morbid curiosity about the whole notion of bone collecting that I don't understand.
Yeah.
Even as an archaeologist, someone who's excavated
totally
bones,
agree
right? I don't, yeah, there's always an attitude that I bring to that, and it's never mine.
Yeah.
It belongs to the country that person is from.
Dan, you were telling us how last summer you worked in three different places. A place called Truk Lagoon, I don't know if I'm saying that correctly, which is in the Federated States of Micronesia.
yeah, I need to know where that is.
the Marshall Islands and Denmark. So they all sound very different places. Well, perhaps the first two are close enough, but Denmark certainly is another world to the previous two. So all this in one summer, how did you manage that?
Last year was a very busy year. I had to take a little time off of teaching at the college, actually, to accomplish all the field work and all the report writing that went along with it.
Rolling Stones had a shorter world tour.
I feel as old as the Rolling Stones, though. Maybe a little bit older. So Chuuk. All right. So the name of the country today is Chuuk, Chuuk. But in World War II, it was called Truk, Truk. And I think that's because of a misspelling on the Americans' part of what the local Chuukis actually called their own country. So it became known as Truk Lagoon on all the charts. And anyway, this is a coral atoll in the middle of the West Pacific, near the equator. Nearest largest island would be Guam, I suppose.
Okay.
Right? Guam is sort of Malta-sized, maybe a little bit bigger than Malta, but not much. And we have to fly to Guam in order to get to Chuuk.
Of course.
So there's an island hopper that we take to get all the way out there. It is out in the middle of nowhere. There's nothing around. except other little coral atolls that make up part of the Micronesia Republic. It's a beautiful coral atoll. There's several large mountainous islands in the middle of it. I believe it's about 200 square nautical miles in size, in just inside the lagoon. It's big.
Wow.
And the Japanese used Chuuk, or I'll just say Truk Lagoon, the traditional name, used Truk Lagoon as a major naval base. It was their, what we call their Pearl Harbor.
Yep.
They had ship refit facilities. They kept their fleet at anchor there, thinking that it would be safe and impregnable from American forces. And it was until February 1944 when we finally had enough of a westward movement across the Pacific where we could not invade Truk, but bomb it to smithereens, which is what we did. Eight aircraft carrier task force, sorry, one task force with eight aircraft carriers was involved with this. Famous ships like the Intrepid and the Enterprise were involved, and they airbombed it and just knocked everything out. They sank 50 Japanese ships in the lagoon.
Wow.
All real close to each other, too. It's a diver's paradise today.
I can imagine.
These are huge ships, oilers, tankers, freighters, a couple of warships. There's a submarine that sank there also. And they're all in a very small area. It's a diver's paradise. And so what happened on the American side? Well, we shot down, the Americans shot down almost 200 Japanese planes in that day. There are four Japanese runways. They tried to launch everything, but couldn't get everything up in time. Mm. So we destroyed them in the air through dogfights, and we destroyed them on the ground. But in the process, we lost around 29 aircraft. Somewhere approaching 200 Americans.
Servicemen.
Yeah. And so there's American airplanes to be found in the lagoon. Well, we've been looking since 2017. We've been going back, except for COVID, we've been going back every summer to try to find more. So far, we've found three American planes. Now, our job at Project Recover is not ironically, to recover the airplanes, it's to find them. And then we inform the Defense Department, of course. We write up our scientific reports on what we find. We document it. We photograph everything. We do a little bit of looking around on the site. And if there are bones, we'll recover them if we see them. But our job is to document and then hand it over to the DPA.
So bones are extracted from the plane wrecks?
Well,
to be exhumed in U.S. territory.
Yeah, so our job isn't to do that, though. Our job is to
find them and then
identify the aircraft, which means we can identify the missing personnel. Because if we can get aircraft serial numbers, then we can identify exactly who was on that plane. We know exactly who was on that plane. And if there happen to be bones visible on the site, then yes, we have to collect them because they could be missing in no time. They could be dragged away by octopus or divers or whoever. Hmm. But our job isn't to recover bones per se. That's left to another team who comes along who is equipped with barges, you know, underwater vacuum cleaners. All you know, basically people who can do that much more effectively and completely than we can. Huh. Yeah.
And the Marshall Islands in Denmark, similar kind of work?
Yeah, the Marshall Islands had, when we went there last summer, had two different aircraft that we were looking for. We found neither, unfortunately, after 2 weeks of searching. Beautiful place to work, very isolated. We had to take a liveaboard dive boat just to get there from another island, a long sea voyage just to get to that atoll. But we did find one airplane, a Wildcat.
Okay.
And it was lying upside down, and we thought, oh, this is not even in our cases. No one even knows about this plane. Huh. So luckily we had internet, and we started talking to our historian. He started digging. Colin Colburn is his name, a brilliant historian. And he found that it was a missing naval plane that, and there were the person who was flying it before it crashed survived the crash and was recovered heroically by an amphibious plane. So, and we found out the name of the pilot even. And so we tried to look the pilot up. Again, this is all doing internet sleuthing. We tried to look the pilot up to see if we could tell this person, we found your plane. And unfortunately, the pilot had passed away just a couple of months prior to the discovery. And we thought, oh, it's too bad. Anyway, we informed the family, and Yeah, it was the right thing to do. Huh. But we still have two more planes to go find.
So you're going to be going back.
We hope to go back, but it really is up to the Defense Department. Mm.
If you want someone to tag along who knows Maltese, maybe Maltese comes in handy. I'll volunteer.
We'd love to have you, Leo.
Maltese is very close to whatever they speak on the Marshall Islands.
And Denmark.
Okay, let me tell you about Denmark then. So Denmark is fascinating because there are a lot of air losses in Danish waters, North Sea, Baltic Sea. Mm. Nazi Germany was shooting down all kinds of bombers because they're coming over from England,
yes,
flying over Northern Europe on the way to bomb targets in Germany. Mm-hmm. And so it was, you know, the Germans had a great vested interest in setting up anti-aircraft batteries and trying to knock down American aircraft before they could drop their bombs. So in this particular case, we were looking for two B-24 bombers with multiple losses in both aircraft. Typically, B-24 Liberators have 10 crew, but in this case, there was a collision, a mid-air collision, had nothing really to do with anything, just faulty, you know, navigation, that resulted in both planes crashing into the Baltic Sea off the coast of Denmark. One plane was already known by local divers. Hmm. Local divers know where everything is. If they don't, the fishermen do, and they talk to each other. And we went looking for the other bomber. And unfortunately, we did not find that bomber either, even though it should have been easily
close,
within a mile.
I was going to ask you
everywhere.
That.
And the only place we didn't look was in a place where we can't look, a place that is on the charts forbidden to do any sort of underwater work.
Oh,
okay.
If you look on a nautical chart of anywhere in the world, there are these places where the local governments say, you can't look here. You can't do anything underwater here. And this happens to be in one of those places.
And you have to wonder what is in there.
Yeah, you have to wonder. We're hoping to go back there. We have to get permission through the Danish government. But we're convinced now, I'm convinced anyway, about 100%, that that is where the other B-24 is. Uh-huh. But one of the first B-24 is being excavated. It has been over the last couple of seasons. And they're having great success. So that's great news.
Amazing.
Mm-hmm. This is truly interesting work. You know, not many people can come on the show and have a more interesting job than I do, and this is one of them. We're running out of time, and we want to talk about a little bit about the equipment, the machines that you're working on. Mm. That I'm sure that our listeners will be so interested to hear.
Yes. Sure. And the role of AI, which must come into your sphere as well, as it does in everything, you know.
Absolutely. You know, until I started working with this group from the University of Delaware, Project Recover, I really didn't know much about anything except sonars and magnetometers. These are old tools for finding shipwrecks. And I thought I knew side scan sonar, and I thought I knew magnetometry. But it turns out the team I work with, they know everything about this stuff. They're really good. They're ocean engineers. They are in one case, the autonomous underwater vehicle we use was actually built and designed by one of the guys who we work with. And so we use these vehicles, these autonomous underwater vehicles with the sonar on board, to go and map huge areas of seabed. We use two of them at the same time, and we program them, and we drop them in the water, and we just sit back and let them do their magic. We don't have to be in the boat towing something behind us all the time. It does everything on its own, and then when it pops to the surface,
it's got all the data.
It has all the data on board. It calls us, by a satellite phone, and just tells us where it is, and we just go out with a little boat, and we pick it up and bring it back to shore, download all the data. And then we just take a look, right? Well, taking a look takes time. So each autonomous vehicle can cover, I don't know, 1 to 2 square nautical miles of seabed. That's a lot. Hmm. It's looking at the seabed in centimeter resolution. It could see anything larger than a couple of centimeters. So airplanes stand out really well.
Yeah, imagine.
But it takes hours to sift through just one day's of data. So we'll all sit in one room, usually a hotel room somewhere with a big screen, and we'll plug in the laptop, and we'll just sit there and look at all the sonar data. And it takes 2 to 3 hours, and it's already at the end of a long day.
Copious amounts of coffee.
Yeah, lots of coffee, and we're up at 7 a.m. and we're in bed by about midnight. I mean, every night we're working every day of the week for the whole project. So this is where we thought AI could help us, or at least machine learning, right? So machine learning is a, maybe you could say, is a type of AI.
Yeah.
We have a specialist come on our team, and she programmed her using a couple of software packages. She sifted through oodles, gigabytes, terabytes of side scan data to teach the machine how to find aircraft so that we don't have to look through all the data. Huh. Was it successful? Partially. I would say mostly successful. Every time that we suspected there was an aircraft in the data, it said, yep, there's a high probability there's an aircraft. But every now and then it has a hiccup. Hmm. Here's one example. We found a whole Japanese float plane in Truk Lagoon, perfectly intact, sitting on the bottom like it would just park there. And the machine learning did not catch it.
Wow.
And so our prime person who does this, Layla is her name, Layla Character, bless her heart. She got very frustrated. She'd been the one training the program forever, and it missed this very obvious target. It should have identified it as an aircraft, but it didn't. Anyway, we're getting better at it.
Yeah, we're getting there.
We're getting there, exactly.
And we'll be back asking you all about this next year, surely, because this has been an amazing second interview, if I may say so. Professor Dan Davies, thank you for being with us today. On behalf of Manuel Buttigieg, myself, Liam Gauci, I would like to wish you a happy week, and we'll be back same time, same place next week.
Thank you.